Morning, brothers and sisters. Quoting from 2 Chronicles in chapter 6, "Hearken thou to the supplications of thy servant and of thy people Israel, when they shall pray towards this place, and hear thou in heaven thy dwelling place, and when thou hearest, forgive." This quote should sound familiar to us, brothers and sisters, and more than sounding familiar just because we know where it came from, but it should sound familiar because this is what we're here for this morning. This is really the request that we're making when we gather here at this time. When we gather around the table of the emblems this morning, are we not saying, "Hear the prayer of thy children when we come to the table of thy Son, and hear thou in heaven thy dwelling place, and when thou hearest, forgive"? It's for that reason we're here, is it not? We're here because we need the forgiveness of sins. And our only intercessor is the one who's represented in these emblems here on the table this morning. That verse is taken, as we said, from 2 Chronicles chapter 6. And it's in Solomon's prayer at the dedication of the temple. And it's that prayer that Solomon said at that time, or gave at that time, is one of the greatest intercessory prayers that we have recorded. And in his prayer, Solomon expresses a number of situations where a man might sin, or he might be in need, he might be in persecution, whatever the case might be, but he's seeking the Father. And he turns towards this place, the place that Yahweh has chosen to place his name, whether that's the temple 4,000 years ago, or the emblems, or Christ today. "And when this man prays," says Solomon, "then hear thou from heaven thy dwelling place and forgive." Solomon tells us, though, that there is a prerequisite for God hearing in heaven. And he says in verse 30 of that same chapter, he says, "Then hear thou from heaven thy dwelling place and forgive, and render unto every man according unto all his ways, whose heart thou knowest, for thou only knowest the hearts of the children of men." And this is what the theme that we want to take a look at this morning, the thread that we want to pick up, that God requires worship from the heart. On another occasion of a great feast, Hezekiah also prayed. If we look in 2 Chronicles chapter 30, this is the great feast that Hezekiah hosted. And he also offers a great intercessory prayer, praying on behalf of the people. And in this context, if we look in verse 18, we're told, "A multitude of the people, even many of Ephraim and Manasseh and Issachar and Zebulun, had not cleansed themselves. Yet did they eat the Passover otherwise than it was written." And this point is made because under the law, only those who were cleansed, those who were not undefiled at the time of the Passover, could partake of the Passover. If you had touched a dead body or you had done something that that had caused you to be unclean during that period, you could not partake of the Passover. And yet this was the reinstitution of the Passover, and Hezekiah wanted everyone to partake. He didn't want anyone to be left out. And yet there were certain individuals who could not, under the law, partake of the Passover. And it continues at the end of verse 18, "But Hezekiah prayed for them, saying, the good Yahweh pardon every one that prepares his heart to seek God, Yahweh the God of his fathers, though he be not cleansed according to the purification of the sanctuary. And Yahweh hearkened unto Hezekiah and healed the people." So Hezekiah is recognizing that these individuals under the law should not be allowed to partake of the Passover. And yet he's praying. He says, "You know the hearts of men. And based on the state of their heart, can you allow them to partake of the Passover?" And Yahweh hears him. But again, the hearing of this prayer is based on the state of the heart of these individuals. It was not based on the works of the law. It wasn't a checklist. It wasn't a series of requirements that they met or didn't meet. It was their the state of their heart and dedication to worshiping God. In these and many other cases, intercession is made based on the state of this individual's heart, and we could provide many examples throughout the Old and New Testament. It's ridiculous to think that when Solomon said, when any man prays towards this place, that he was asking that anyone who faces east when he prays be heard and should be forgiven. If it was merely the fact that he was facing the temple, as it reads, literally, then whoever throughout the land who might be directionally challenged and faced north or south or west, their prayer wouldn't be heard. Of course, we know that's ludicrous. That's not how God works. But if we pause for a second and we think about it, is that what we actually believe? When we put it that way, it sounds ludicrous, but it's very easy to slip into that way of thought, not consciously, but in action. We might never consciously say it, but being human, it's easy to slip into that mode of thinking, because we show up on Sunday, and we take part of the bread and the wine, and thus God hears our prayers. But it's not our presence here, and it's not partaking of the literal bread and wine that is the basis for God hearing our prayers. It's the basis that God will hear our prayers this morning is the basis of our heart, where our heart is. And it's no more accurate to say that when the man faced east, that he would be heard, than we say, being here this morning, we will be heard. Where are our minds this morning, brothers and sisters? That's what God is concerned about. I know I'm guilty at times of being distracted. The events of Saturday or the week before might still be with me. And sitting here in a quiet hall, our mind tends to wander. Or maybe it's what faces us Monday, what needs to get done. But God's asking for us to be focused on Him, for our hearts to be dedicated to Him. And based on the state of our heart, He will pardon everyone that prepares his heart to seek God. We are here to remember the opportunity of salvation that has been extended to us, of what Christ did to secure that opportunity for us. But that opportunity requires upkeep and continued effort on our part, also known as self-examination, if we don't want to lose that opportunity. Thus, part of partaking of the emblems this morning has to do with self-inspection and looking at where we can improve our lives. In the story of Jehoshaphat in 2 Chronicles chapter 20, just turning over a couple pages, there's a bit of an interjection. And we know this story. 2 Chronicles chapter 20 and verse 33. Talking about Jehoshaphat and his cleansing of the land, he says, "Howbeit the high places, or the places of idol worship, were not taken away, for as yet the people had not prepared their hearts to seek God, the God of their fathers." And we know this is Israel's great continual failure, all the way from the very beginning. They could not seem to overcome this idol worship. Alongside this, though, through the Kings and the Chronicles records, through the prophets, etc., there is a small thread that the basis of their failure, or the reason for their failure, is because of their hearts. Their hearts were never prepared to worship or to dedicate themselves fully to the worship of God. And it doesn't matter how many times the good kings tried to cleanse the land and remove the idols, that was only a superficial thing, but they could not prepare the hearts of the people. Another place that we've seen this thread recently is in our Ezekiel reading that we've read this morning. And it's not just in the reading this morning, but it's actually a thread that runs through all of Ezekiel. One of the key themes of Ezekiel is the heart of the nation. And Ezekiel harps on this throughout his warnings to Israel. If we just flip over, just as an example, and look in Ezekiel chapter 6. We'll go through a couple examples fairly quickly. Ezekiel 6 and verse 9, about halfway down, he says, "Because I am broken with their whorish hearts." With their hearts, they've committed adultery, spiritual adultery. Ezekiel chapter 11, he says, "I will give them one heart, and I will put a new spirit within you. And I will take the stony heart out of their flesh, and will give them a heart of flesh." And in verse 21, two verses down, "But as for them whose heart walketh after the heart of their detestable things and their abominations, I will recompense their way upon their own heads, saith the Lord God." Also in chapter 13, in verse 17, "Likewise, thou son of man, set thy face against the daughters of thy people, which prophesy out of their own heart." And jumping down to verse 22, "Because with the lies ye have made the heart of the righteous sad." So Ezekiel's dwelling on this aspect of their lack of faithfulness to God. It's because their heart. So when you come to chapter 14, which we read this morning, chapter 14 really focuses on this issue, as Brother Mike prayed in his prayer this morning. Looking in verse 3, "Son of man, these men have set up idols in their heart and put the stumbling block of their iniquity before their face. Should I be inquired of at all by them? Therefore speak unto them and say unto them, Thus saith Adonai Yahweh, every man whose house of the house of Israel that setteth up his idols in his heart." And again in verse 5, "that I may take the house of Israel in their own heart." And finally in verse 7, "for every one of the house of Israel, or the stranger which sojourneth in the land of Israel, which separateth himself from me, and setteth up his idols in his heart, and putteth the stumbling block of his iniquity before his face, and cometh to a prophet to inquire of him concerning me, I, Yahweh, will answer him by myself." So why is it phrased this way? If the problem with Israel was their idolatry throughout the 430 years of them being in the land, why is it phrased this way here? Why is it that God's phrasing it or focusing on the heart? We know they set up literal idols in their houses, in the gates, in the cities, even in the temple. So why is it God is not mentioning that? He's mentioning the idols they set up in their heart. The reason being is because in Ezekiel's day, the nation had gotten smart, as we would say. In generations before, they said, "We don't believe in God," or "We don't believe in Yahweh. We believe in these other gods. We believe in this golden calf. That's the one that took us out of Egypt. Or we believe in Molech or Baal or whatever the popular god of that generation might be." But in Ezekiel's day, they had learned that they can't say that. They can't turn away from worshiping Yahweh. They've got to continue worshiping Yahweh, whatever idols they worship on the side. They've got to continue an appearance of worshiping the true God. So they could say, "See, we do the sacrifices." And in Ezekiel's day, they did. They kept the law, they kept the sacrifices, and they came to the feast. But they also had the other idols set up as well. And how do we know that? How do we know that in Ezekiel's day, God says, "You know what? I don't care that you come to keep my feast, because it's not where your heart is." If we, even in the chapter that we read here in Ezekiel 14, if we look, every time he mentions that these men have set up idols in their heart, he also says, they set up idols in their heart and they come before me to inquire of a prophet. Because they're saying, "Oh yes, this is a prophet of Yahweh. He will tell us what is right." But they still had idols in their heart. And if we jump over to the end of Ezekiel, or towards the end, in chapter 33. chapter 33 and verse 31. We read, "They come to me as the people come, and they sit before thee as my people." So they came Sunday mornings, and they sat and worshiped, and they sang praises. And they hear thy words, but they will not do them. For with their mouth they show much love, but their heart goeth after their covetousness. So here is the people who had an appearance of doing the correct worship, and yet it was very deceptive, because in their hearts they still continued with their idols. And that's why in Ezekiel chapter 14, God dwells or addresses the idols that they have set up in their heart. So the question arises, if in so many cases of failure or acceptance, it was on the basis of the heart, how do we then prepare our heart? How do we apply this to ourselves if we're to serve God in truth? Or what does it mean to prepare our heart? When we consider the Hebrew meaning of the word, it holds greater weight than what we might think of just in the English. We might think of it as preparing, as in to get ready. But the Hebrew word is kun, which means to stand or to set up, to fasten, to fix, or establish. So we get the idea that whatever this word is speaking about, it's being set up for a particular purpose. If we set something up, it is usually for a particular purpose that it should serve. When something is fastened, it becomes unmovable. If we establish something, we're making it unquestionable. So how does this relate in the context of what we are doing with our hearts? To prepare our heart to come before God means that our desire, our intent, and our goals must be focused, fixed, and established. That we should be determined that this is the way that we're going to live our lives, and this is the way that we will worship. We are fixed on having a heart that is in tune with Yahweh's heart. This principle of preparing our hearts to seek and worship God is a very important one, as we can see, not just for Israel in their day, but for us as well. Before we look at a few positive examples, let's look at a couple examples of where this word is used. If we look in Joshua chapter 3, the same word kun Joshua chapter 3 and verse 17. And the priest, this is crossing the river Jordan, the priest that bare the ark of the covenant of Yahweh stood firm on dry ground in the midst of Jordan. And all the Israelites passed over on dry ground until the people were passed clean over Jordan. These priests stood firm. That word firm is the same word kun, to prepare. So these priests went and they stood and they didn't move. Again in 1 Chronicles 16. First Chronicles 16 and verse 30. Fear before him, all the earth. The world also shall be stable, that it be not moved. That word stable is the same word, prepare. And finally, in Psalms 112, and verses 5 to 7. A good man shows favor and lendeth. He will guide his affairs in discretion. Surely he shall not be moved forever. The righteous shall be in everlasting remembrance. He shall not be afraid of evil tidings. His heart is fixed, trusting in Yahweh. And here we actually have two examples. We have there in verse 6, his heart being fixed, immovable, and trusting in Yahweh. But we also have in verse 6, he shall not be moved. And that's the exact opposite of the word. That word move means to slip or slide, or slip like a slippery surface. So the heart of the righteous man is not one that slips around and cannot find solid ground. It's fixed. It knows where it should be, and it does not deviate from that. So from these we get at least a better understanding of what God means when he says we're to prepare our hearts. We're to fix our hearts on him, and we're to set it up for a particular purpose. And one last context that we want to look at this word is in 2 Chronicles, or we won't turn it up because it spans a number of chapters. But at the end of 1 Chronicles and the beginning of 2 Chronicles, it's the context of David and Solomon preparing or gathering the material to build the temple of Yahweh. And it says over and over again in this context that David prepared the material and Solomon prepared the material. And that word is the same word, kum. So what does this really have to do with fixing or establishing something? When David and Solomon were gathering the material together for the building of the temple, they set it aside for a particular purpose. David had, we're told, a store of gold and silver and material. And that was David's store. But he also had a second store of material just for the temple. Because it said he gathered this much gold and he put it in his store. And he put that much gold in the store of the material for the temple. And that material was prepared. It was fixed for a particular purpose and it could not be used for anything but that purpose. So how much more, or what a better example can we have than that? We are the building material for the temple of God. And God sets us aside for a particular purpose, and it can't be used for anything else. Our hearts have to be prepared and dedicated for that sole purpose of worshiping God. And it's that context that we come back to that verse that we opened with. That at the dedication of that same temple that they were preparing for, Solomon says, "Hear thou from heaven thy dwelling place and forgive, and render unto every man according to his ways, whose heart thou knowest." What better time to have our hearts and minds solely dedicated for this purpose than this morning when we come around the table of our Lord? We come here asking for forgiveness for our failures. But if our prayers are to be heard, they are to be from a state of mind where our hearts have been dedicated. How important is this, then, that God requires this? Christ says, when he's asked, what is the greatest commandment? He says, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and all your soul and with all your mind. This is the first and great commandment. And he goes on to point out that this isn't just the greatest of the Ten Commandments. It's this commandment that the whole law was founded on, the worship of the heart. And if we come over to the Luke reading this morning, Luke chapter 10, we have this example of the lawyer. In verse 25, he says, this lawyer says, he stood up and tempted Christ, saying, "Master, what shall I do to inherit eternal life?" And Christ says, "Well, what does the law say?" And he responds, "Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, and with all thy soul, and with all thy strength, and with all thy mind, and thy neighbor as thyself." So this lawyer, being a lawyer, was looking for things that he could do, actions he could take that would secure his salvation. He was used to the Jewish way of looking at the law as a checklist, and that was their requirements for righteousness. But Christ says, no, it's not the law. It's your heart. That's what God desires. That's the commandment that you have to follow for your salvation. But the lawyer could not accept that unless he dwells on the second aspect of who is my neighbor, the legalistic aspect. And this is the most difficult. The commandment of thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart is the most difficult commandment to keep. Because I'm sure none of us have gone out this week and killed somebody. And I'm sure we haven't gone out and stolen something. But have we loved the Lord our God with all our heart this whole week? That's the difficult thing. And Israel's continual failure at doing this is the same as our continual failure. Because we're made of the same weak flesh. In Psalm 78, we're told, which rehearses the history of Israel, their heart was not right with him, neither were they steadfast with their covenant. And is that not descriptive of our everyday life as well? Again, in the same psalm, in Psalm 78, that they might not be as their fathers, a stubborn and rebellious generation, a generation that set not their heart aright, whose spirit was not steadfast with God. And in 1 Samuel chapter 7, if we turn up 1 Samuel, chapter 7 and verse 3. And Samuel spake unto all the house of Israel, saying, if you return unto Yahweh with all your hearts, then put away the strange gods and Ashtaroth from among you, and prepare your hearts unto Yahweh, and serve him only, and he will deliver you out of the hand of the Philistines. So that Israel was in persecution, and God, through Samuel, saying, just turn to me. Just prepare your hearts. Just give me your hearts, and I'll save you. That's all I ask of you. And yet, it's not that simple, because we continually, and Israel continually, could not do that. Have we not made a similar covenant, brethren and sisters, as Israel did in their day? We've all made a covenant with God when we died through Christ in baptism, a covenant to seek God with all our hearts and to dedicate our hearts to his service. But what about Christ? As Solomon prayed that when the children of Israel turned their face towards the temple, the mercy seat, the place where God had chosen to place his name, so we are turning to Christ, our mercy seat, the place that Yahweh has chosen to manifest his name in these days. David, Hezekiah, Josiah, and many of the other faithful men that we have on record, whose hearts and lives were focused on God, cannot compare it to this man that we're here to remember this morning. From an early age of 12, Christ knew that he must be about his Father's business. And through his ministry, he said, my will is to do the Father's will. And finally, at the end of his ministry and going to the cross, he says, for this purpose came I into this world. Nothing in this world could ever distract that man for a moment from being the greatest building block in the temple that his Father was preparing, the cornerstone on which every other piece is built. He lived his life unwavering, keeping that single greatest commandment to love the Lord, his God, with all his heart and mind, without fail. And this is who we stand before, not only as our example, but the intercessor for our sins. He is the one that we have to answer to for the idols that we cannot put away or let go of. He is the one who searches the hearts, as we're told in Romans 8. He that searcheth the heart knoweth what is the mind of the Spirit, because he maketh intercession for the saints according to the will of God. And we're here to remember him and the example that he set up before us for us to pattern our lives after. We're told in Job, if you prepare your heart and stretch out your hands towards him, then he shall lift up your face without spot. And is that not what we desire this morning? A week's gone by. We've all fallen short in some way. And we're turning our faces towards this place that God's chosen to put his name. And we're asking forgiveness that we might be without spot and blameless. But just being here isn't enough. No more than just facing east was what was required. Just facing the emblems and speaking the words will not cause God to hear us any more than when the children of Israel prayed towards the temple. We must approach with a steadfast and fixed heart. Then we can say, "Hearken thou to the supplication of thy servants and of thy people, when they shall pray towards this place, and hear thou in heaven thy dwelling place. When thou hearest, forgive."